listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Thursday saw more evidence of major progress towards peace on the Korean Peninsula at the United Nations. This week is the opening of the 73rd General Assembly of the UN, and as is customary, the foreign ministers of the various members of the Security Council sat in at a Security Council meeting on Thursday. The topic was Korea. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was presiding.
Time and time again, over the past quarter century, the United Nations has made it clear. The world cannot accept a nuclear-armed North Korea. That's not just the United States' position, that is the world's position. Past diplomatic attempts to halt North Korea's nuclear and ballistic missile development were unsuccessful. But now we're at the dawn of a new day. Since taking office, President Trump has led the international pressure campaign that has resulted in the first significant diplomatic breakthrough in decades. During President Trump and Chairman Kim's historic Singapore summit, Chairman Kim committed to work towards the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. The two leaders share a common personal understanding of what must take place for the transformation of the United States-DPRK relations. The United States continues to engage with North Korea to implement the commitments made in Singapore. Yesterday, I had a very positive meeting with Foreign Minister Ri Yong-ho to discuss how we can move forward on all four commitments in the Singapore joint statement. We also discussed a second summit between President Trump and Chairman Kim Jong-un. We must not forget what's brought us this far, the historic international pressure campaign that this council has made possible through the sanctions that it imposed. Until the final denuclearization of the DPRK is achieved and fully verified, it is our solemn collective responsibility to fully implement all UN Security Council resolutions pertaining to North Korea. President Trump has made abundantly clear that if Chairman Kim follows through on his commitments, a much brighter future lies ahead for North Korea and its people. And the United States will be at the forefront of facilitating that bright future. We want to see that time come as quickly as possible. But the path to peace and a brighter future is only through diplomacy and only denuclearization. That means any other path North Korea may choose will inevitably lead to ever-increasing isolation and pressure. It is imperative for members of the United Nations to take that to heart. Enforcement of UN Security Council sanctions must continue vigorously and without fail until we realize the fully final verified denuclearization. The members of this council must set the example on that effort, and we must all hold each other accountable. Particularly, we must all be accountable to enforce Resolution 2397, which lowered the annual cap on refined petroleum imports to North Korea. The United States has assessed, and we can say in no uncertain terms, that the cap of 500,000 barrels has been breached this year. We continue to see illegal imports of additional refined petroleum using ship-to-ship transfers, which are clearly prohibited under the UN resolution. As UN Security Council members, we must convey to the captains of these ships, to their owners, and anyone else involved in these transfers that we are watching them, and that they must cease their illicit activity. We must all be accountable for cutting off North Korea's illegal coal exports, which provide funds that go directly to its WMD programs. And we must be accountable, too, for curbing the number of North Korean laborers permitted within our borders. The United States is troubled by recent reports that member states, including members of the Security Council, are hosting new North Korean laborers. This violates the spirit and letter of the Security Council resolutions that we all agreed to uphold. And while sanctions remain part of the total approach we are pursuing to rid the Korean Peninsula of nuclear weapons, I want to finish on a positive note. We are well into a diplomatic process, and we hope, indeed we want, to see this through to a successful end. I'm pleased that based upon recent exchanges between President Trump and Chairman Kim, that the President has directed me to travel to Pyongyang next month to meet with Chairman Kim and to accelerate that process. I want to reiterate that the future can be very bright for North Korea if it makes good on its commitment to final, fully verified denuclearization. It will lead to the positive transformation of the USDPRK relations, to greater prosperity for the North Korean people, and to an enduring peace. In our vision for a free and open Indo-Pacific, nations are strong, sovereign, connected, prosperous, and at peace. But that vision for the region will never be complete if we fail to bring about this transformation on the Korean Peninsula. The Korean people, the region, and the world will never realize the full promise of the future if we do not seize this unprecedented diplomatic opening for peace. I said at the beginning of my statement that we are at the dawn of a new day in the world's relationship with North Korea. We do not yet know what that day will bring, but we are hopeful that the current breakthrough in diplomacy will yield a brighter future for North Korea and a safer world for all of us. Thank you, and I look forward to the discussion.
This was China's Foreign Minister, Ambassador Wang Yi.
Mr. President, in the course of this year, we've seen important positive developments on the Korean Peninsula. Things have again returned to the track of dialogue and negotiation. The DPRK and the ROK, seizing the opportunity of the Pyeongchang Winter Olympics, have realized a turnaround in their relations and opened a new chapter of reconciliation and cooperation. This April, the whole world was watching when Chairman Kim and President Moon together made a first step across the military demarcation line. And last week, again, we heard good news. The DPRK and the ROK had their third summit this year and released a Pyongyang joint declaration. The two Koreas have thus achieved an all-round improvement of relations and jointly undertaken to turn the peninsula into a peaceful place free of nuclear weapons and nuclear threat. China applauds the political decisiveness and courage demonstrated by the two leaders. China firmly supports the two countries in turning their leaders' consensus into concrete actions, in building mutual trust, and in advancing reconciliation and cooperation on the peninsula. In their historic summit in Singapore this June, the DPRK and the United States reached important common understandings on comprehensive denuclearization and the building of a peace mechanism on the peninsula. This serves the shared interests of all parties, including the U.S. and the DPRK, and meets the need of regional peace and stability. It is also what the international community hopes to see. The DPRK and the U.S. are in active preparations for their second summit. China supports the U.S. and the DPRK in keeping the dialogue going, in meeting each other halfway, and in working for more deliverables from this meeting. Mr. President, China's position on the peninsula issue is consistent. China is committed to denuclearization, to peace and stability on the peninsula, and to resolving issues through dialogue and consultation. China has put in great efforts and energy in this cause. The recent positive developments on the peninsula are exactly what China has been working for over the years. At this juncture, the Security Council has a duty and need to send a united and clear message to support and encourage all parties to accelerate the process of political settlement. All parties need to work together for a peaceful and stable peninsula. This is an aspiration shared by the DPRK, the ROK, and all other countries in the region. The peninsula issue is essentially about security. To realize peace on the peninsula, the key is to address the legitimate security concerns of all parties in an appropriate and balanced manner. The DPRK have suspended its nuclear and missile tests and gradually dismantled some facilities, and the U.S. and the ROK on their part have suspended military exercises. Building on that, a timely release of an end-of-war declaration would dispel the specter of war on the peninsula and articulate the political will of having no more war. It will help build basic trust. It will further facilitate denuclearization and put in place the conditions needed for the final peace accord. So in China's view, a political and wise decision must be made. All parties need to work together for a completely denuclearized peninsula. Denuclearization is a prerequisite for lasting peace on the peninsula. It is what we must do to uphold the nuclear non-proliferation regime and the shared. It represents the shared objective of concerted global efforts. China believes that the most effective way to denuclearization is for it to be advanced in parallel with the building of a peace mechanism on the peninsula, so that the two can support and reinforce each other and be settled together. The main players in this process are the DPRK and the U.S., but all stakeholders are obligated to make their respective efforts. The six-party talks has played an important role. It will remain an indispensable multilateral platform. The Security Council should also form consensus in a timely manner to facilitate and support this process. All parties need to work together for a peninsula of mutually beneficial cooperation. So denuclearization is ultimately aimed at bringing to the people on the peninsula and in the region a better life of greater prosperity, peace, and happiness. The past few decades, cooperation around the peninsula has stalled due to various disruptions. But this year, the DPRK has made a major decision to shift its focus to economic development. We believe this decision deserves welcome and support from the international community. As denuclearization moves forward, as long as Security Council resolutions are continued to be enforced, all parties can gradually carry out, where conditions are right, practical cooperation to improve people's well-being. We hope that the day when denuclearization is achieved is also when rejuvenation comes to the peninsula. The Security Council, within its mandate enshrined in the UN Charter, has adopted several resolutions related to the DPRK. As long as these resolutions remain valid, they must continue to be implemented fully and accurately in their entirety. China firmly believes that pressure is not the end. Both implementing sanctions and promoting political settlement are equally important under Security Council resolutions. They must be advanced in parallel, not in a partial or selective way. There is a provision in the Security Council resolutions that the Council is prepared to modify the sanction measures in light of the DPRK's compliance. Now, given the positive developments in the inter-Korean and the DPRK-US relations and the DPRK's important pledges and actions on denuclearization, China believes that the Security Council needs to consider invoking in due course this provision to encourage the DPRK and other relevant parties to move denuclearization further ahead. This year marks the 65th anniversary of the Korean War Armistice Agreement. To realize complete denuclearization and build a peace mechanism on the peninsula is China's consistent proposition and a shared international consensus. China calls on all parties to demonstrate political courage, advance dialogue and negotiation, and together work for durable peace. China will continue to contribute to this objective. Thank you, Mr. President.
North Korea is bounded by three countries, South Korea, China, and the Russian Federation. This was Russia's Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov.
Mr. President, colleagues, over the past few months, significant progress has been achieved in resolving the problems of the Korean Peninsula. The region has seen significant reduction in tension as a result of the moratorium declared in Pyongyang in April on launches of missiles and nuclear tests and closing of the test site in Pyongyang, and the decision by the United States and the Republic of Korea to postpone indefinitely their military maneuvers. We note the successful implementation of the inter-Korean agreements enshrined in the Panmunjom Declaration from the 27th of April and the September visit to the DPRK of the President of South Korea, Moon Jae-in, during which visit the Pyongyang Declaration was signed. That declaration sets out the intention to increase multifaceted cooperation and also the obligation undertaken to dismantle the missile range in Tonchani and the closure of nuclear facilities in Anben, which gives us hope for stabilization of the situation in this part of the world. Russia has actively supported the rapprochement between South and North Korea and the resolution of the problems of the Korean Peninsula overall. We have been calling on partners for a long time toward this, including as part of the implementation of the roadmap that was adopted last summer by Russia and China, and which is de facto being implemented now. We're convinced that building trust is the key to resolving the problems on the Korean Peninsula through political and diplomatic means. The agreement reached in Pyongyang between North and South on reestablishing rail and road connections is a very important step in this direction. We call on members of the Security Council to support the initiative of Pyongyang and Seoul, which fully responds to the spirit of the decisions we have adopted. It is unacceptable that for sanctions against the DPRK to become an instrument of collective punishment. The lack of trust between Washington and Pyongyang hinders the development of joint measures, which the parties could take at the same time and sequentially to move the process of resolving outstanding differences forward. We should think about a system of international guarantees, which could play a decisive role in resolving the problem of the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Against the backdrop of the readiness demonstrated by Pyongyang to cooperate and the progress in stabilizing the situation in the region, it seems inappropriate and untimely when our Western partners have imposed a course towards tightening the sanctions regime against DPRK. Given that Pyongyang has taken important steps towards denuclearization, it would seem that it would be logical to support this momentum, to strengthen this momentum. In this connection, I would like to hear an explanation for the reasons of why some of our colleagues in the Security Council have stubbornly ruled out the possibility of any positive signal from the Security Council regarding the steps taken by Pyongyang towards denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula. I would just like to remind you that any negotiations are a two-way street. Steps by the DPRK towards gradual disarmament should followed by easing of sanctions. There should be reaction towards every action. This is necessary to avoid a situation which, for example, occurred with respect to the JCPOA, where our American colleagues, based on bogus pretexts, withdrew from the Iranian nuclear deal unilaterally and thus violated their obligations in the framework of the Security Council. Institutions and mechanisms of the United Nations and its Security Council must be used to support the process of resolving inter-Korean dialogue rather than becoming a hindrance. Only then can we speak about effectively resolving the problems that have accumulated in the region, including the nuclear one, based on dialogue and mutually acceptable agreements. It would be difficult to achieve this through sanctions and pressure. Now, the excessive use of the sanctions instruments of the Security Council have already become the reason why member states and international organizations often cannot normally maintain even humanitarian, diplomatic, and sporting ties with the DPRK, which have nothing to do with the development of nuclear and missile programs. A further increase of sanctions goes beyond cutting off financing of banned missile and nuclear programs on Pyongyang, and in fact is a threat to North Korean citizens and will bring extreme socioeconomic and humanitarian sufferings. It's important to recall that all resolutions of the Security Council on DPRK contain not only a sanctions component, but provisions on measures to achieve a political and diplomatic solution to the situation on the Korean Peninsula. Disregarding these provisions amounts to not complying with the consensus agreements of the Security Council on the DPRK. Even more unacceptable are autonomous or secondary sanctions against DPRK or other states which have been introduced by the United States and some of their allies, in addition and going around the Security Council. Such unilateral restrictions not only undermine the sovereignty and the legitimate interests of member states and run counter to international norms of trade, but overall undermine the integrity of the restrictions agreed within the Security Council. Once again, we call on countries that introduce such sanctions to refrain from this practice. We note that increasingly these restrictions have become an instrument of unfair competition and intimidating economic agents from third countries. The example of DPRK is quite indicative. Even what isn't banned by the sanctions regime of the Security Council is very difficult to carry out due to these illicit practices and the fear of entrepreneurs to find themselves on these punitive lists. It's unacceptable such attempts to cover these restrictions under the authority of the Security Council or under the 1718 Committee and using the committee to undermine or to suggest that some countries are not complying with their obligations. We're strongly in favor of having the Security Council and the 1718 Committee to contribute as much as possible to finding the political and diplomatic solutions to the problems of the Korean Peninsula and creating a mechanism for security in northeastern Asia. We think it's very timely for the Security Council to send a clear signal in support of the positive momentum of the situation around the Korean Peninsula. This could be done, for example, by adopting a relevant resolution. And we want to prepare a draft of such a resolution and propose it to the Security Council to consider it. We also believe it's very important to regularly discuss whether it's advisable to review certain various restrictions against DPRK as it moves towards giving up its nuclear weapons. For example, we might think about some modest steps. The resolutions of the Security Council do allow for a review of restrictions in cases where there's progress on the political track. In the Panmunjom and the Pyongyang declarations, as I said, confirm the interests of both parties parties to implement joint economic projects. Well, if we welcome these agreements, let's think of possibly creating within the 17-18 committee specific conditions for considering applications for exemptions from the sanctions regime to carry out projects of inter-Korean cooperation on which Pyongyang and Seoul have agreed to. Russia is ready to very closely cooperate with all interested parties in the interest of ensuring peace, stability, and comprehensive resolution of the problems of the Korean Peninsula based on equal, non-discriminatory negotiations with the participation of all interested parties. Thank you very much for your attention.
This was South Korea's Foreign Minister, Kang Kyung-hwa.
Mr. President, Secretary Pompeo, thank you very much for convening this meeting and the opportunity for me to speak to the Council. As you state, Mr. President, we are indeed at the dawn of a new day with regard to the challenge of North Korea's denuclearization. And it is useful to take a step back and to realize just how new. Barely a year ago, here in the Council, we were counting the numbers of North Korea's nuclear tests and ballistic missile launches and calling for united action to bring North Korea to the right side of history. At the time, the thought of President Trump and Chairman Kim Jong-un shaking hands and holding a summit would have been considered a daydream. It would have been a fantasy to imagine President Moon Jae-in and Chairman Kim Jong-un on top of Mount Paektu taking photos together. But here we are, and we have a different set of numbers to ponder. Three inter-Korean summits and the first ever U.S.-North Korea summit in a matter of 5 months, with more likely to follow in the months to come. Mr. President, allow me to quickly cap the milestone developments on the Korean Peninsula that have brought us to this point. They started with North Korea's participation in the 2018 Pyeongchang Winter Olympic and Paralympic Games in February and March, to which the North Korean leaders sent a high-level delegation. And this was quickly followed by the visit of President Moon's special envoy to Pyongyang in early March, who came back with a first-hand confirmation of Chairman Kim's intentions on denuclearization. In April, North Korea took a step forward by announcing that it would discontinue nuclear tests as well as ballistic missile tests of intercontinental range. It also announced that it would dismantle its nuclear test site, which it did a month later. On the 27th of April, the two Koreas held an inter-Korean summit, the first in more than a decade. In the outcome, the Panmunjom Declaration, the two sides agreed to actively cooperate for the establishment of a permanent and stable peace regime on the Korean Peninsula and confirmed the common goal of realizing a nuclear-free Korean Peninsula through complete denuclearization. And at the first ever U.S.-North Korea summit on the 12th of June, the top leaders of the two countries also confirmed the common goal of building a lasting and stable peace regime on the Korean Peninsula. And the North Korean leader reaffirmed his commitment to complete denuclearization. And last week, President Moon visited Pyongyang for his third summit meeting with Chairman Kim. They discussed at length the denuclearization challenge, including concrete ways to bring it about. And for the first time, in his own voice, the North Korean leader stated his commitment to turn the Korean Peninsula into a land of peace, free of nuclear weapons and threat. And this at a joint press conference with President Moon, which was broadcast live to the rest of the world. More specifically, in the Pyongyang Joint Declaration, North Korea announced that it will permanently dismantle its Dongchangli missile engine test site and launch platform under the observation of experts from relevant countries, and indicated its willingness to take additional measures, such as the permanent dismantlement of the nuclear facilities at Yongbyon, as the United States takes corresponding measures. And now, hopes are high that the upcoming U.S.-North Korean negotiations will produce more concrete outcomes. Mr. President, the international community has been able to bring North Korea back to the dialogue through a well-measured combination of diplomatic tools. In particular, the Security Council played a critical role. the Council unanimously adopted a series of sanctions in response to North Korea's nuclear and missile provocations, and the international community acted with unity in fully implementing them, sending a clear message to North Korea that its pursuit of nuclear weapons program will never be accepted. But at the same time, the door for dialogue was kept open to bring North Korea back to the negotiating table. And eventually, the will of the international community has prevailed, and North Korea changed course and came to the path of dialogue and peaceful resolution. In the last few months, it has taken a series of, for the first time, actions that were unthinkable only a year ago. As for the government of the Republic of Korea, we are committed to continuing to work with the international community to ensure that the Council's sanctions are faithfully implemented, even as we continue to engage North Korea to facilitate substantial progress towards complete denuclearization. We're also furthering inter-Korean dialogue to solidify the momentum for reconciliation and better relations. And this includes implementing the comprehensive military agreement signed in Pyongyang, which aims to eliminate the threat of war and prevent accidental clashes. Mr. President, last week, while in North Korea, many of us joined President Moon and Chairman Kim on their visit to Mount Baekdu. And as the highest point on the Korean Peninsula, this mountain bears a very special meaning for all Koreans. The microclimate of Mount Baekdu makes the weather very unpredictable. Sunny and clear one moment, but foggy and drizzly the next. We were there in stunningly clear and sunny weather, but that was probably the exception than the norm. Our path to complete denuclearization and the establishment of a permanent peace on the Korean Peninsula might prove likewise uneasy periods of uncertainty and wariness, interspersed by moments of a step change in progress and clear visibility toward our goal. But in the longer scheme of things, comparing where we were a year ago and where we are today, the situation has definitively become more clear, and visibility has been greatly enhanced. The change has been possible because of bold, far-sighted, and determined leadership, much of which has rested in you, Mr. Pompeo, and enhanced the unity of the international community. And as long as we stay this course, I am confident that the months ahead will take us even closer to our shared goal of realizing a nuclear-free Korean Peninsula that is permanently at peace. Thank you very much.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. U.S. President Donald Trump took center stage at the United Nations this week. The Middle East was very much on his mind, particularly Iran. For some sitting in the General Assembly, Trump's words were simply laughable. However, what is happening in the Middle East and beyond is anything but funny. Crosstalking Iran and the Middle East, I'm joined by my guest, Kamal Alam in London. He is a military analyst. And in New York, we cross to Rosbeh Alabadi. He is a partner at Global Growth Advisors International Strategic Consultancy Group. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Let me go to Rosbeh in New York first. I'm sure you saw Donald Trump's speech to the United Nations. Much of it had to do with Iran and how Donald Trump sees the world. We all do know that in the General Assembly, diplomats, heads of states, found some of his commentary funny. They laughed, okay? A short montage of what he had to say, using his words here. Iran's leaders sow chaos, death, and disruption. Saudi Arabia, the king and crown prince, are pursuing bold new reforms. And Israel proudly celebrates its 70th anniversary as a thriving democracy. That created a lot of giggles and smiles. What was he trying to say? Is this a path towards conflict? Because we're going to talk later in the program about how the Europeans are trying to move away from the dollar system by creating its own SWIFT system. And we can talk about what's going on in Syria. What happened in that speech? Is it, it has any meaning, consequence in your mind? Go ahead in New York.
Peter, you're right. The president, I think he kind of mixed up his audience because he started his talk by, again, as a self-centered individual that he is. And I think he thought that he's talking to a, to his constituency yep. somewhere in West Virginia rather yep. than to a global body. So what we saw with the president, he came out and he said his administration has done much more than any other administration in history of the United States. And if you can make German diplomats laugh, you are really doing something wrong, particularly on UNGA, United Nations General Assembly opening. But also the president of the United States had very, very harsh words for Iran. Just that morning, the president of the United States tweeted and called Mr. Rouhani, Iranian president, a lovely man. And then a few hours later, he attacked it on the center stage of the UN. Also, I have to say, the numbers that the president threw out, in particular with the numbers of employment, was wrong. We did not lose that many jobs, as he said it, to China. We lost it to automation here in the United States. And he gave some really, in a way, wrong assessments about the global politics. He also furthermore, Peter, introduced a new doctrine. Let's call it the Trump doctrine. He called it the replacing the doctrine of globalization with the doctrine of, if you will, patriotism, whatever that means.
Okay.
And he also talked about, he had really nice words for the North Korean leader, and that was kind of surprising. So all in all, the GPA of his, political GPA of his, if you will, UNGA speech was a big F. And it was not good for American leadership, and certainly was not good for the executive branch having this kind of a show on a center stage of the United Nations.
Yeah, it's Kamal. I think Rosemary makes a really good point. I think that Trump always mistakes a large crowd for one of his rallies and his base here. But Kamal, one of the things I found rather peculiar, to be in the extreme, is that Trump talked at great length about the importance of sovereignty, then turns around and asks the whole world to destroy the sovereignty of a sovereign state, the sovereign state of Iran. I mean, it was intensely contradictory. How can you talk about defending one country's sovereignty when trying to destroy another's? Go ahead, in London.
Yes, there was definitely a speech full of contradictions, but specifics with regards to Iran and sovereignty of other nations, that it makes no sense. One could see that there's a path that the Americans under Trump are laying out, and they laid it out there against Iran. Later on, he repeated that in the UNC council that he chaired. It doesn't make any sense. And if anything, what he's doing is he's isolating even the closest American allies, who you could see them cringing in their seats. You could see people feeling very uncomfortable about the language Trump was using, because the Europeans especially are moving towards a different path towards Iran. And it's not looking good for the U.S. with regards to international organizations, whether it be the UN, NATO, the World Bank, all of them are now looking the other way because the U.S. is saying things which no one is happy with.
Okay, well, I'm glad you brought that up about allies here. Nikki Haley was on the Fox News channel trying to explain how the United States is dealing with its allies vis-a-vis Iran. And her take on it, I think, will be very different from what you gentlemen will think and our audience. Let's listen to what she had to say.
The European Union has this so wrong, and it's all because of their ego and their pride. You've got Ms. Mogherini, who helped get this deal together. She's trying to hold a deal together because she did it, but she's not looking out for the best interests of the European countries.
Okay, let me go back to New York. Rose Bay, I mean, so Nikki Haley is looking after the best interest of Europe. I guess that's what she's trying to mean. Ego and pride. I think, again, those two words are misplaced on the wrong people in the wrong country. Is this show how much the United States, particularly the Trump administration in its foreign policy, is out of step with the world? I mean, they're trying to develop a special purpose vehicle that will include the European Union, Russia, and China. This is all at the expense of the U.S. dollar that is really the key to American global dominance. Without the dollar, it's a different game. Go ahead, Rose Bay in New York.
Well, Peter, in the long term, that's going to be the case. In the long term, this 800-pound financial gorilla that is being controlled by the United States is not going to be in place. It's going to be replaced with other financial mechanisms. But let's talk about the short term. First of all, I think Ambassador Haley and others in the White House, in particular Trump administration, they're furious over not what the Europeans are doing. They thought by leaving the Iran deal, JCPOA will fall apart. It has not thus far. Now, let's take a look at what the Europeans are doing. The Europeans are following what the international community has committed to do. The same international community, the same UN Security Council that the United States voted to, enact the Security Council Resolution 2231, which, again, President Trump's very much so overtly violated it back in May. But let's go back to this financial mechanism. If we look at it in the short term, the Europeans are trying to help Iran. But in the long term, what the United States has done through the mechanism of sanctions and punishment in a, frankly, a unilateral manner, it has, in a way, diverted the attention of its closest allies since the Second World War. We're looking at the UK, we're looking at France, and we're looking at Germany to go together with, as the Americans will call it, strange bedfellows such as Russia and China to find a mechanism to, in a way, reduce the influence of, if you will, this 800-pound gorilla. So the bigger signal is the Iran deal and, if you will, the JCPOA is becoming a prelude for the world to diversify away its financial mechanism from Washington and from, frankly, New York as a financial hub.
That's so perfectly put. Kamal, you know, one of the things, again, one of the ironies that Donald Trump wants a new deal some sort with Iran, and the Iranians will come to him. But at the same time, he's demonizing a government that he says he's willing to sit down and talk to. He's demonizing a government that he'd like to see overthrown. I mean, that is a galling contradiction. Go ahead in London.
Yes, absolutely. Any talk of a new deal is unlikely to go down well, even in the European capitals, because however flawed the deal might be, all the European countries support it, and it's working. We've heard quite a few heads of states even yesterday say that Iran is sticking to their side of the bargain. There is no need to finish this deal. And we see the U.S. is also putting pressure on countries like India, Japan, and even Turkey not to do business with Iran. But again, if anything else, it's backfiring because even Turkey is moving extremely close to Iran on loads of business deals. And Turkey is a good example where a NATO member, which is feeling more and more isolated within NATO and is now feeling closer to Russia and Iran with regard to the Middle East, but also business. And with respect to the dollar, a lot of countries are now deciding to trade in their local currencies. China is trading in the yuan and most of South Asia and East Asia. So it's a recurrent theme all over the world. The more the U.S. pushes, more Trump pushes against institutions and countries, the more it seems to go against them.
You know, Rosemary, let me go back to New York with you. I mean, in the second part of the program, I want to talk about Syria, but Kamal already mentioned it. It is quite interesting, and I'm glad you have a historical perspective here. We have now a deal that Turkey and Russia made vis-a-vis Syria to deal with Idlib, and we'll talk about the S-300s. But that deal was made with a member of NATO and Russia without the United States involved. That is something new. We haven't seen something like that before. So even within the alliance, the United States is not being able to control all of its members. Go ahead in New York.
You're right, Peter. First of all, I think the deal that has taken place right now, if you look at Recep Tayyip Erdogan or frankly anybody else in the region, they realize that politics and international affairs at the end of the day is local. They are in that location. So what the Turks are worried about is they're worried about the refugees. frankly, what even Germany is worried about is worried about the refugees. And if this, if you will, war will not be contained, we're going to have a problem. At the end of the day, what we have to realize, through Syria, the geopolitics of the region has been changing. The chapter is changing. It's moving away from this long 7-year civil war into a period of hopefully stabilization and reconstruction. In that phase, what we're seeing from Ankara, what we're seeing in Moscow and Tehran, and frankly elsewhere, they're saying we want to be part of that future dialogue. And that's why we're seeing, in a way, realignments of interests. And Turkey's leading the charge on that, rightly so.
Okay, gentlemen, we're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Iran and the Middle East. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let me go back to Kamal in London here. I guess I'll use an American phrase, but I'm sure you'll understand it. Is there a new sheriff in the Middle East? Because we have the situation after the fatal shooting down of a Russian plane, and the Russians put blame on the Israelis for it. The S-300 anti-missile system is being deployed there. Syria's wanted that for a long time, and it was after this dreadful incident that Russia finally agreed. How much has this changed the game on the ground or in the air, as it were? Go ahead, in London.
I think it's a significant change, and it just goes to show you the trajectory of the Middle East over the last 2 years since Russian intervention in Syria. Russia is definitely the biggest diplomatic player, not just in Syria, but in the Middle East as a whole. To give you an example, the Turkish are buying Russian defense systems. Qataris are, the Saudis are, even the Egyptians are. But the S-300 going back to Syria means everything changes in the air, because Syria, which had a very weak air defense system, which kept getting attacked by Israelis almost on a daily basis, will now be able to stand up to the Israelis, and effectively makes it extremely difficult for the Israelis to attack Syria, because effectively that means they're going to attack the Russian air defense system. So the Israelis have made a colossal mistake in downing the aircraft, which they say is an accident.
You know, Rosemary, in New York, you have to think that the Russians and the Syrians are doing something right when John Bolton, you know, goes nuclear about it, because he's furious by that decision. By his logic, it is a destabilizing decision. That counterintuitive thinking, it is the most stabilizing thing that could happen to avoid having this war continue and to spread. I think it was a remarkable a political, military, and diplomatic move. Go ahead, in New York.
Right, Peter. First of all, I think what the Russians did was a political move, the sale of the S-300. And let me elaborate on that. A few weeks ago, or earlier this month, we saw that the Russian plane was shot down by the Syrian forces because they thought it was an Israeli plane trying to go after the Iranian target. This is a complexity we're dealing with in Syria. What the Russians decided to do is a purely a political move, and here's the reason. By deploying S-300, Russians are containing a potential danger and friction point between the Iranians and the Israelis in a Syrian geography. That's purely what the Russians are after. The Russians want to de-escalate the situation. The goal is not to put anyone on offensive mode or defensive mode. And they decided the best way to do it is this way, which would lead into this new chapter. The new chapter is if the Israelis decide to take any unilateral actions against Iranians in Syria, they will probably think twice, or they probably will not do it, or probably discuss it with the Russians. So that is called a de-escalation mechanism. All in all, I think that's what the Russians are did it. And Mr. Bolton, I don't think it's a barometer for Russians' thinking or, frankly, Russians' satisfaction with when it comes to this issue. So Moscow made a strategic political decision by selling the S-300. It was not a military decision, and I think it was a long-term wise decision, and it was a long-term game that the Moscow played in Syria.
You know, Kamal, you know, you're a military expert. Do you think the Israelis will test this missile system that is being set up in Syria? Do you think that they're going to go that far? Are they going to probe? What do you think?
I think they'll be very careful, and highly unlikely that they'd go. Having said that, the Israelis always test the limits of all the norms of war, and they go to the extremes. The Syrians have been trying to get the S-300 for almost 10 years, and one of the key reasons it didn't get it was the Israelis were able to convince Moscow that don't give the Syrians S-300, as I said, even before the war, because they know the S-300 was a game changer in the region. So that's why I think it's significant, and for the Israelis to still go after targets in Syria, it becomes extremely difficult. And for them to test it will actually be quite a task, because they will be putting their pilots in grave danger.
Rosemary, in New York, do you think now, because it was, you know, everybody has their red lines when it comes to Syria, and when the prior to the deal that the Russia and Turkey made, there was a lot of noise coming out of Washington, actually the British and the French and even the Germans were even thinking about parlaying in this here. Does this change this now? Because if they're not going to be able to use airstrikes to support their groups, and we can leave it unspoken what their friends are in Idlib and around, I mean, do you think that this is another move where they're going to actually consider stop supporting these groups here and actually find a conciliation point where these terrorists can be moved out? Where they go, I don't know. That's Erdogan's biggest nightmare. And I'm skeptical of the deal with Turkey. It has to get some legs for me to really believe in it, because Turkey has a lot of culpability and a lot of responsibility to defuse the situation in Idlib, because, you know, I've used the word sovereignty in this program many times. Well, Syria is a sovereign country and it wants sovereign control. And once Idlib is taken care of, then the Americans must leave Syria because they're not invited there. They're there illegally under international law. Go ahead in New York.
Sure, Peter. I think Idlib is a strategically, politically, and frankly, geographically, the last rebel-held location in region in Syria, and it would mark the end of the civil war in Syria. However, I do not believe at this point certain actors in the region, as well as Tel Aviv and Washington, would like to see the end to Idlib province, if you will, conflict. So what they try to do is they try to shy the Damascus, Moscow, Ankara, and Tehran from making an attack. And we saw President Trump, ironically, thank the Iranians, Turks, and Syrians, and the Russians for their position on Idlib. But bottom line is this situation cannot be contained this way. On the other hand, we have a humanitarian catastrophe. Any type of conflict could probably lead into a 1 to 1.5 million refugees moving up north towards the Turkish borders. So all in all, I think that what the challenge for Moscow, for Ankara, for Damascus and Tehran will be to find a way to, in a way, separate from the regional actors in the GCC countries and as well as Tel Aviv and Washington, to find a way to come with some sort of a peace process with them. And if it doesn't happen, we will see some sort of offensive actions. And I think it is not best to the interest of everyone. But if you look at the from a 30,000 feet, Peter, the biggest, the most important thing is right now Washington, Tel Aviv, and GCC actors would like to drag this conflict using Idlib. That is not to the best interest of Syria, and I think that is the point that Moscow, Tehran, and others are advocating.
You know, Kamal, one of the interesting caveats is that Russia is the only country that can talk to almost every single actor in this conflict here, and you've seen it, ceasefire attempts were then, but other parties didn't want to see a ceasefire. With the S-300s here, Syria literally has its own sovereignty within its grasp. Does this send a signal to outsiders to stop supporting their proxies? Because eventually, ultimately, it's a lost cause. And I've mentioned before on this program, the U.S. is there without a mission. It's searching for a mission. But if we have the regional players, and I'm talking about Riyadh as well, and the Israelis, you know, they owe the Russians right now, okay? This is an interesting moment, an interesting diplomatic opening that could possibly be pushed forward. Because if airstrikes from abroad are off the table now, maybe there'll be cooler thinking. What do you think?
Absolutely, because if you look at the Russian diplomatic maneuvers, as you said, they've been able to talk to every side in this conflict, whether it's the Israelis, the Turks, various Syrian groups, the Syrian government, of course, and all the other Arab League nations as well. So the S-300 basically means the sovereignty of the Syrian Arab Republic is restored. And this is something the Russians said they were here to do. They want to support the state institutions of Syria, which is a legitimate recognized government in the United Nations, with more than half of the Arab League also having their embassies and ambassadors. And this is important because a lot of people in the UN and NATO keep saying the Syrian government is not a government, it's a regime. It's a government. And even within the Arab League, more than half of the ambassadors are in Damascus. So that means Syria's government is recognized as a state. And the Russians have helped them at the international level on the diplomatic scene. The Chinese have also come in, so have the Indians, the Brazilians, the South African, which completes the BRICS troika. So the S-300, I think, is the final, sentence that says the Syrian sovereignty is back. Slowly but surely, their military is also rebuilding, whereby other countries and proxies will think twice before attacking a country which sits on the UN table.
You know, Rosemary, let me go back in New York. Let's finish up on Iran here. We had Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, attending a MEK meeting that's in New York as well, a group that wants to see the illegal overthrow of the government in Iran. The United States is a really big supporter of it in almost every single way. Is this, and with the sanctions and all of this, I mean, do you think ultimately the Trump administration will attempt some kind of regime change within? Because they're nonstop talking about Iran. I mean, they have Iran on their brain. 1 minute, Rose Bay in New York. Go ahead.
Short answer is I don't think so. Unfortunately, everything that has come out of Mr. Trump's mouth and his national security advisors and Secretary of State has been tactical moves. The latest example of that is the State Department coming up with a publication called the Outlaw Regime. It is nothing but, if you will, a think tank-based ideology of Iranians, or Iran's activities are bad. But that is not a strategy. So at this time, however, I do not see a strategy behind Mr. Trump's, if you will, team. What I do see is the vacancy of not having a strategy could get us into very dangerous grounds. And those dangerous grounds could lead into unintended consequences that could be a hot conflict. I hope it doesn't happen that way, but I just see too many tactics, no strategy. And that is precisely the danger, Peter.
Yeah, a good example of that is keeping American troops in Syria as some kind of contingency plan, waiting for a strategy to be hatched. Very, very good point. Gentlemen, we've run out of time. Many thanks to my guests in London and in New York. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.